And as it's just at the top of the hour now, I'd like to introduce our presenter today, Sonia Gabrielian, MD, MPH, who's a psychiatrist and health services researcher at the VA Greater Los Angeles, and also an assistant professor at UCLA. Sonia, can I turn things over to you?
Thanks, everyone, for joining in. So I'm excited to be here today to talk about some work that we've done looking at the notion of retention in one of the VA's largest homeless programs, the VA Supported Housing Program. I'd like to give a special acknowledgement to HSR&D for funding this study, as well as acknowledge our project team that's listed on this slide. So we have a few poll questions just to get a flavor for who's on the phone. The first question is, what is your primary role in VA? We've got some answer choices there for ranging from student, clinician, researcher, administrators, and other.
I've launched the poll, and answers are streaming in. We have about 65% of the audience answering. Usually levels off around 80%, so I'll let it go for a few more moments, Sonia. And things have leveled off, so I'll close the poll and share out the results. And Dr. Gabrielian, 4% answered that they are student, trainee, or fellow. 28% answered clinician. 26% answered researcher. 17% administrator, manager, or policymaker. And 26% answered other. And audience members, if you'd like, you can go ahead and use the questions pane to give more detail on what other means, and I can read that back to Dr. Gabrielian at an opportune time. Back to you.
Great. So it sounds like we've got a good mix of folks at sort of in all different domains in VA. The second and final poll question just queries your primary area of interest. We guess that we would have folks from the homelessness domain, mental health, and primary care. Sometimes it's hard to choose just one area, but if you could rank your primary area of interest, that would be great.
And the poll is launched. I'm sorry, Sonia, I'm having trouble with my microphone, so I'm just going to go ahead and speak. I can't actually hear you right now. We have about 61% people voted. I'm going to let it run a little bit longer. And it's leveled off at around 8%. So I'm going to close the poll and share out the results. And what we have is that 32% answered homelessness, 37% answered mental health, 17% answered primary care, and 14% answered other. Hopefully you can all hear me, and now it's back to you, Dr. Gabrielian.
All right. So this is our Spotlight on VA Mental Health series. So we wanted to take a few slides to really just highlight the centers of excellence within the VA. And those encompass our MIRECs, our Mental Illness Research, Education, and Clinical. These, the Centers of Excellence have a shared mission, and that is to improve the health and well-being of veterans through world-class cutting-edge science, education, and enhanced clinical care. There's shared structure between the Centers of Excellence in that there's this notion of combining education, research, and clinical care into a single program with the idea of sort of rapidly moving between scientific discovery and implementation. So there's 15 centers across the country. Each center has a distinct specialization. Typically, that's a specific disorder, a specific type of problem, a particular population. And the goal across those centers, regardless of specialization, is to understand the complex context of health services access and delivery. Each of the centers has significant collaborative partnerships with clinical research and educational experts from their academic affiliates and other organizations. And we have the MIREC website at the bottom of the screen if you're interested in learning more. We also wanted to take a slide to highlight the MIREC that I'm within, which is our VISN 22 Desert Pacific MIREC. So we mentioned in the last slide that each MIREC has a specific goal. In VISN 22, the MIREC's goal is to improve long-term functional outcomes of veterans with chronic psychotic disorders with a focus on schizophrenia. Our MIREC is partnered with our VA HSR&D COIN at Los Angeles, and our health services unit within the MIREC works to facilitate the implementation of recovery-oriented services for veterans with serious mental illness, really focused on VA clinical settings. So with that backdrop, I'll move into project that I'm here to talk about today. So I wanted to start off with some few core definitions for the people who might work outside the homelessness domain. I think when we conjure up an image of homeless people, we're often thinking about our unsheltered homeless who are chronically homeless and on the streets. That's really not the majority, and it certainly doesn't encompass all homeless people. When we think of homeless persons and when we're talking about homeless persons today, I'm really referring to people who lack a fixed, regular, and adequate nighttime residence. So when we ask people if where they slept last night, that's sort of a typical clinical question that we use to query people's housing status, people would identify a primary nighttime residence that is a supervised publicly or privately operated shelter. It might be a temporary residence, a transitional housing setting. It could be someone that's couch surfing, going between friend and family members' couches or apartments or homes. Or it's people who are street homeless, which is buildings, so places not regular sleeping accommodations for homeless, for human beings. So how many veterans are homeless? The way that we typically capture homeless people in terms of the prevalence is challenging, and we typically use a method called the point-in-time count. And on a single day in January, which we're here in California where it's not that cold, but elsewhere in the country, in January, you get the largest number of people who are actually in some sort of shelter due to weather conditions. So on a single night in 2017, over 40,000 veterans were homeless in the U.S. So that was about 9% of all homeless adults identifying as veterans. You can think over the course of a year, that number of homeless people certainly will increase both in the civilian world and the veteran world. Since 2009, the VA has really had a core focus on addressing veteran homelessness, has put tremendous resources into veteran homelessness, and seen a significant decrease in the number. If we look from 2009 to 2017, we actually see a 45% decrease in the number of veterans who are homeless. And if you look every single year at the point-in-time counts that are released each year, veteran homelessness actually dropped each of those years with the exception of two, 2010 and 2017. So our most recent point-in-time count does show a slight bump. Supported housing is one of several evidence-based practices that's really been advancing the field of homelessness and shown to improve both housing and health. So if we look at the traditional medical model of treating homelessness, services were typically delivered on a linear continuum. So someone would come into our emergency department, we would find out that they didn't have a place to stay, we would find them emergency shelter that night, which typically is a place where they sort of pack up their belongings, sleep for the night, pack up their belongings in the morning, and go without a lot of services. That would allow them to transition to a transitional housing setting, typically where there was a case manager or some sort of supportive services, with the idea that you could identify what the patient's rehabilitative need was that was preventing independent housing. Upon identifying that rehabilitative need, the patient would be transitioned into a residential treatment program to identify, to sort of further flesh out and treat that need. So that could be a mental health problem, it could be a substance abuse problem, it could be a vocational need, or many others. And that would allow the person to transition to independent housing. The challenge with this model is that it's very provider-centered. So when we talk to a lot of our sort of medical trainees about this, and we ask what the challenges are with this model, there's often sort of a point of confusion, and it's because we're trained in this notion, in the sort of medical model, that we as providers will know when someone is ready for the next step in treatment, or we will know when someone is ready for independent housing. But the studies show us that that's really not the case. In addition, there's this idea that what if a patient doesn't desire treatment for whatever that rehabilitative identified need is? So if the person doesn't want to stop drinking, doesn't want to take medications for mental health problems, do they not deserve independent housing? So the supportive housing notion was born out of that sort of paradigm and that concern. And here, housing is not dependent on health service receipt. So independent housing is provided in the community and supportive services are provided. Supportive services include linkages to healthcare, but healthcare is not mandated in the supportive housing model. So this is a practice that has shown very good evidence. Prior research substantiates the positive health and psychosocial outcomes of supported housing, and I have some of the few outcomes that have been looked at below on the screen. So decreased substance abuse, fewer hospitalizations, increased perceived autonomy, and improved housing retention have been all shown out of our supported housing projects that have been studied carefully throughout the country and elsewhere as well. Within VA, the VA Supported Housing Program, or the VASH program, has really been the center of the VA's plan to end veteran homelessness. HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, has recognized that housing is a critical determinant of health. And in 1992, HUD partnered with the VA to form the HUD-VA Supported Housing Program. The program is actually called HUD-VASH, but I will sort of shorten it for purposes of speaking clearly to VASH today. And what VASH provides is it provides Section 8 vouchers, which are a subsidy from a financial perspective. That comes from HUD, and case management coming from VA is offered to eligible veterans. And this is what we call a voucher variant of Housing First. So the voucher actually provides financial support, the VA provides supportive services, and the program has grown immensely since then. Over 85,000 vouchers have been distributed since 2008. One thing that we don't know much about is about 6% of participants return to homelessness each year. And this is a group that we don't know a lot about because we typically have studied at a large scale the outcomes of supported housing, which are quite good, with a lot fewer sort of returns into sort of recidivistic homelessness than many of our other housing services. So, in my clinical practice, what got me interested in this was seeing patients who were failing supported housing. So we had this sort of gold standard homeless program, but there were patients who we were putting in this program, and they were really not succeeding. And I'll give you an example of a patient whose alias I've coined as Adam Jenkins. So 32-year-old OEF-OIF combat veteran with PTSD, 100% service-connected, traumatic brain injury, seizure disorder, and substance use disorder. So from a pure financial perspective, with his 100% service connection, which he had had for years, it's a little bit challenging to see from a purely financial perspective why he couldn't be housed. He had been homeless for about a year and a half after the end of a relationship. He was very pleasant, very creative, very well-spoken, a very likable guy who you could imagine interviewing for an apartment and someone would want him to live there. He had quite a few symptoms, profound hypervigilance, a lot of nightmares, worked with our assertive community treatment team here at Los Angeles, and was able to get project-based VASH housing. So that's a building that's designated for veterans in VASH or other people on Section 8 housing in downtown Los Angeles. Initially, he did very well there. He got a dog. He became very focused on caring for his pet. But he increased his alcohol use. We had this revolving cycle where he would come to detox. He would relapse. It progressed to other substance abuse. He was eventually evicted, ended up living on Skid Row, very close to where his apartment was located. So the question for me, this was sort of one of many clinical examples I saw of people failing supported housing, is who were these people, what predicted who would exit supported housing, and what could we do in terms of intervention development to help retain this very vulnerable group of veterans? So that's what this study was born from. So with the goal of informing intervention development, there were a few core research questions. First, I was interested in identifying factors associated with exits from VASH after people achieved housing. So there's a distinct group of people who enroll in the program, get a voucher, have sort of all the factors in place that would allow them to get housing and don't get it. That's an interesting and sort of separate study, but this is a group of people who actually get an apartment and exit that apartment prematurely. I was also hoping to understand sort of the daily lives of people in VASH, so understand what daily challenges veterans faced in the VASH program, and to think through how veterans in VASH solve problems in their lives and what problem-solving skills they employed, and looking at if those problem-solving skills were associated with VASH outcomes. So there's sort of two domains. Sort of that first question wanted to look at demographic factors, diagnoses, and health service utilization patterns associated with exits. And the last two questions really looked at this notion of challenges faced in VASH, problem-solving skills, and how those problem-solving skills might play a role in VASH outcomes. So interrelated sort of concepts, but sort of distinct types of research questions. So I'll tell you about our study sample. So HOMES is VA's homeless registry. For those of you who don't work in homelessness, it's sort of equivalent to CDW if you want to think about it that way, but it's sort of in the homelessness realm, and it's a registry of all homeless services offered within VA. We used the HOMES data to identify VASH enrollees who were actually placed in an apartment in 2011 or 2012, and we made sort of two distinct groups. Our group that we call stayers are individuals who were housed for greater than or equal to 1 year, and you can see that was the majority of our sample, close to 95%. Our exiters were people who were housed for less than 1 year and who exited for negative reasons. So there are some people who exit the program because they get employment, they reconnect with family, so that's a positive exit. We weren't as interested in that. We were really interested in people who got housed but who left because they needed a higher level of care or because something happened to sort of decrease their ability to function in the community. So we did a few things. On this On a sort of larger scale, we took all 85 people who exited the program that I just mentioned in that Exeter group, and we compared them to a randomly selected sample of 85 stayers. Then what we did is we purposefully selected 20 Exeters and 20 stayers for semi-structured qualitative interviews and more detailed chart review. We sort of purposely selected the sample looking to get a heterogeneous sample on a few variables, age, gender, and the presence or absence of a serious mental illness diagnosis. We also got data from staff, so we did some semi-structured interviews with leadership in our homeless program. We did a few focus groups as well as some individual interviews because we wanted to sort of capture all the different providers in our program. So we spoke to social workers, nurses, and consumer providers or peer supports in our BASH program here at Los Angeles. So on this slide, I've outlined our conceptual framework, and this is the behavioral model for vulnerable populations, and this really dictated our chart review, and it dictated a lot of our qualitative interviews as well, and I'll get into that a bit more. Really what this model postulates is that there's sort of predisposing factors, so demographic factors, chronicity of homelessness, era of service, that interact with enabling factors, so income, if you're assigned to a primary care team, the distance between your apartment and a primary care team, that problem-solving sort of abilities that I mentioned in our research questions, we viewed that as an enabling factor. Those interplayed with needs, so needs being medical and mental health and substance abuse needs, and health behaviors really being captured in this study as VA health service utilization to influence our outcome of interest, which is if someone was a stayer or an exiter. So in terms of our quantitative analysis, we used a technique called recursive partitioning, which is a technique that can be used to sort of generate a decision tree that predicts outcome from a group of predictors. This is a technique that's good when you have a relatively small sample size with a large number of predictors, and allows you to sort of distill those large number of predictors into a few simple if-then rules that allow you to distinguish between two different groups. So it independently evaluates each predictor on our outcome, the outcome here being stayer versus exeter, and the variable and its corresponding cut point that splits the data by those outcomes, stayers and exeters, become the first predictor, and the process is subsequently repeated until there's no further improvement of the model. This can be a little bit confusing to think about from a methodologic perspective without the real data. I think it will become more clear for those that may not be familiar with this technique when I show the results. In terms of our qualitative data, we did a few things. So our individual interviews really focused on patients' perceived needs while they were in BASH. We focused a lot on interpersonal issues that came up while in BASH, and we really wanted to hone in on this notion of problems and challenges faced during when people were actually housed, both the stayers and the exiters. Staff interviews really look to understand the alignment between BASH services and the evaluated needs of the veteran. So what services did BASH offer and what services did BASH providers believe that veterans needed? We also wanted to get a sense of consumer behaviors that staff saw that contributed to loss of BASH housing. We did thematic analyses on these data, and with the idea of sort of honing in on this idea of cognition and problem solving, we identified problems identified in the transcripts. So in addition to our traditional thematic analyses, we also identified hurdles, needs, opportunities, circumstances, sort of this broad notion of challenges that we saw in the transcripts. We wanted to categorize the types of problems that people faced and to tally the frequency of these problems, and we wanted to rank problem-solving sophistication with this idea that performance on a task, so problem-solving skills being a task, the idea that performance may associate with outcomes. We looked at all the problems faced by any given patient. We categorized the types of problems. We looked at people's ability to solve those problems, and we ranked the highest level problem solving that we saw, and we considered that a proxy for each individual's problem solving abilities. So there were three levels of problem solving, and this is a typography that was developed in a video ethnography study done with patients in schizophrenia. So we translated that to our housing world. So there's three levels. Rote and rudimentary problem solving was this idea of a very rote solution to a problem, or relying on someone else to solve a problem without putting any effort in yourself. Anticipatory and additive problem solving was someone who would put a little bit more thought into the problem. The answer to a problem wasn't simply rote. They actually would consider consequences of a solution, weigh those consequences, and make a decision. Complex and creative problem solving showed a greater degree of that sort of anticipatory and additive effect. There were multi-step plans. There was resilience in actually coming up with a solution to a problem. So each of our problem solving skills that we coded in the interviews, we ranked as one of these three levels. I want to present a snapshot of our sample. So I talked about looking at that larger sample. So we have our stayers here, our exiters here. So this was all 85 exiters, a randomly selected group of 85 stayers, a total sample of 170. So I'll really hone in on the differences between the sample. So the exiters were more predominantly male. They had higher rates of chronicity of homelessness. They had higher numbers of emergency department visits over the past year, higher rates of serious mental illness, and lower rates of primary care engagement. We didn't see much difference sort of in just the presence or absence of substance use disorders. You could speculate you would see something more if you did a more detailed assessment. We also didn't see statistically significant differences in the rates of mental health engagement. So I mentioned our recursive partitioning technique to look at our quantitative data. So here you can see our decision rules for classifying veterans as stayers versus exiters. So we had 170 participants, we had 11 potential predictor variables, and this is the model that we came up with. So at the top of the model, you would first look at if an individual had a mental health admission. If someone had one or more mental health admission, this is in the year before entering the VASH program, 100% of people who had one or more mental health admissions exited the program, which was interesting. For those that had less than one admission, so no admissions, the next level on the tree was chronicity of homelessness. If you were acutely homeless, so a new onset homelessness hadn't been going on for quite some time, most of those folks were stayers. If you use that rule alone, you can see close to 70% of people were classified correctly as stayers. For those that were chronically homeless, primary care engagement became the next branch of the tree. People who engaged in primary care, and we define this as two or more visits to primary care at VA within the year prior to entering VASH. Primary care engagement meant that you tended to be a stayer. You could see the model correctly predicted about 60% of stayer groups. And if you were not engaged, so one or zero primary care visits in the year prior to VASH, those people tended to be exiters. So this model in total actually captured about 86% of stayers correctly, about 48% of exiters correctly. So there's room to improve in the model, but it's certainly a more robust model than what we had sort of come up with from the literature, thinking about how to screen people and thinking about how to identify people at higher risk for exits. Now, I mentioned when we got to the next level, so we honed in on that smaller sample, got 20 of our stayers and 20 of our exiters in a purposive sample, we did much more detailed chart review. Here we looked at 37 potential predictors of VASH outcomes. We did the recursive partitioning analysis, and actually the tree that we came up with only included one variable, and that was the number of emergency department visits in the year prior to apartment move-in. So the individuals with less than two visits, so meaning zero or one visits, they tended to be stayers, and those with two or more visits tended to be exiters. And this model alone correctly classified about 86% of stayers and 48% of our exiters, so sort of similar to the prior slide. So let me move from that into our qualitative themes, because while the model, sort of from a quantitative perspective, provides us with some guidance to think about key risk factors for exiting housing, certainly the qualitative data adds to that immensely. So looking across both our veterans and our staff, and when I talk about staff today, I'm talking about both providers and leadership. The narratives highlighted factors across several of those domains if we think back to our conceptual framework. So in the enabling domain, this notion of motivation really was highlighted. So in my motivation, we'll talk about it more. We're talking about sort of intrinsic motivation within the individual. Unmet needs were also highlighted primarily in the domains of mental health, which I could sort of break up into symptoms, as well as substance use disorders, as well as this notion of independent living skills. So social skills, money management, things along those lines. So I'll go into those themes in a bit more depth, and then I'll go into some of our problem solving findings. So across the board, veterans really thought motivation was critical for VASH retention. And what veterans would describe was this notion of personal accountability. And when we asked about unmet needs, we didn't get as much of that sort of notion of unmet needs from veterans as we got for this idea that veterans had to have it in themselves, that they wanted to make the housing program work. They wanted to sort of make it happen. They wanted to retain housing. They didn't want to just take advantage of the program. Now, an interesting thing here is that this notion of motivation was really captured strongly by the veterans, but not very much by staff. Staff really focused in on unmet needs as salient and VASH retention. They really didn't think this construct of motivation was all that important. When we look at mental health needs, mental health being both symptoms and substance use disorder needs, those were prevalent in both VASH and staff narratives. Psychiatric symptoms often necessitated a more gradual transition into VASH from institutional environments. So we saw folks who had been in institutions or the criminal justice system for quite some time where everything was dictated to them, and then they were thrown into 100% freedom in their apartment, and that was a big challenge for them without a lot of services to help sort of make that transition more smoothly. Interestingly, when we talk to people who exited the program, so that Exeter group, a lot of them desired treatment mandates, and they wanted to be forced to go to appointments. They wanted to be forced to take medications. They wanted to be forced to engage in addiction treatment if they were positive on a drug test, which is very interesting because it goes against sort of the very philosophy of housing first, which is the idea that we link people to services, but we don't require mandates. We were hearing these Exeters tell us, I wish there were mandates and I would have been able to keep my apartment had there been some. We also saw across the board this notion of independent living skills and this profound deficit in independent living skills amongst this group. We saw things like people losing their apartments because they assaulted their apartment managers who were trying to collect their rent. We saw people with money management problems across both groups, but the key distinction for us was that when we talked to our stayers, the people who retained their apartment, they knew what to do if they encountered a money problem. They knew they should talk to their caseworker and that their caseworker had things they could do to allow them to stay in the apartment so that they didn't get evicted. The Exeters often didn't think of turning to case managers, tried to solve problems on their own, often unsuccessfully, and this often escalated to apartment loss. Now, again, veterans and staff wish they could mandate things about interpersonal skills and about financial management. We had veterans telling us they wanted the case manager to sit down with them, work on a budget, make sure they meet the budget, and if they didn't, for an intervention to take place. Again, sort of very contrary to the central notion of housing first as we usually conceptualize it, but I'll talk a little bit at the end of the talk about how we might want to think about reconceptualizing housing first in this particular population to address this notion of mandates that we heard veterans and staff alike wishing for. So to move from that discussion into this notion of problems and problem solving. So we identified problems in all the narratives, and this slide really talks about problems across both the stayer and the Exeter group. So again, we have 40 individuals in this sample, 20 stayers, 20 Exeters. Across that those 40 interviews, we identify 327 problems total. The majority of those problems were instrumental in nature. So you can see 62% of problems were instrumental. About a quarter of the total problems were related to apartment acquisition. We certainly saw financial problems, problems related to daily needs like getting food, getting pots and pans, getting furniture for your apartment. Interpersonal problems were prominent. Most of those interpersonal problems were conflictual. Occasionally, they were supportive. And health-related problems came up time and time again. They were about a quarter of the total problems. Problems related to substance use were most prominent. Mental health and physical health problems certainly came up in our narratives as well. So you can see this slide really is intended to present a snapshot of the types of challenges that people face in housing first. And for us to sort of think through, if we're thinking about intervention development, ways that we can develop real-world interventions to address these sorts of problems. So I want to walk through the three levels of problem solving that I mentioned earlier. So that rote and rudimentary problem solving, where there's a very rote way of addressing a problem, or you turn to someone else and ask them to solve your problem. About a third of our participants, this is across both stayers and Exeters, about a third of participants only employed rote and rudimentary problem solving. We did not see any higher order problem solving in their narratives. As an example, their approach to finding an apartment and addressing their everyday needs in that apartment was very concrete, or it was entirely reliant on HUD-VASH staff. So when we asked these veterans how they find an apartment, they said something like, I looked in the newspaper, there was an ad, it says I'll accept VASH, and they gave me the apartment. So there really wasn't any sort of future thinking about, is this a good apartment for me? What are the problems with this apartment? Should I see other apartments? They were really just looking for a rote solution. Or the other sort of typical scenario we saw is a veteran would say, my case manager helped me with phone services, tutor services. She guided me to absolutely everything I needed as a civilian. So someone else really did all your problem solving for you. So these were people who we saw with only this sort of lowest level problem solving sophistication. In terms of people who demonstrated that second level, that anticipatory and additive problem solving, more than half of participants achieved this level, about 58%. And this was a group who weighed the pros and cons of apartment options. They planned ahead, they brainstormed solutions, and they didn't entirely rely on VASH staff. So for example, one veteran told us, I was looking at apartments within a 10-mile radius. I think it was within a 10-mile radius of the VA because he either worked here or had some treatment going on here. He didn't have transportation, but he had a bicycle, and he knew that's how far he could go from the VA and sort of transport himself. He looked online. He looked on the newspaper. He looked at the websites. He saw about 150 places before he selected one. So he thought ahead. He weighed solutions, and he came up with a solution that worked for him. Similarly, the second quote shows someone who was saving up for an item in their apartment. They thought through how they could get that apartment in a reasonable way. They planned ahead, they budgeted for it, and they were able to succeed in solving the problem of buying a coffee table in this instance. So we saw this quite a bit, 60% of participants. In terms of complex and creative problem solving, we only saw this within two participants, so 5% of our 40 participants. These were people who considered the consequences of decisions. They showed resilience when challenged. They pursued multiple problem-solving strategies simultaneously, and there was a different level of sophistication in their problem-solving approaches. As one example, one participant needed to switch apartments, and he had to juggle the needs of the HUD-VASH program, his housing authority, his landlord, all of which presented unique challenges, as many of us who can work in the VA can sort of relate to and envision. The process was long. He stayed on top of it. He didn't see how anyone could stay on top of it without the case manager. So there was this notion of needing to rely on yourself. If someone came up with an obstacle, he would come up with a way to address that obstacle, and he sort of addressed these three different domains all at once and was resilient when problems came about. So that was relatively rare, but it definitely showed a different level of sophistication that we didn't see in the other narratives. So here to compare problem-solving skills of stayers versus exiters. So you can see that the complex and creative, starting with that level three, you could see that both of the participants, so it's 10% of 20 here. Here we've divided it up as stayers and exiters, so the percentage looks different than it did in the prior slides where we were going across groups. You can see that we have sort of more exiters than stayers, only demonstrating rote and rudimentary. We have both of our complex and creative problem solving being stayers. You can see a few more stayers than exiters showed this level two problem solving. So there were no statistically significant between group differences, but there certainly was a trend, and we'd want to look at this in more depth in future studies as well. So a few of many limitations to this work. This data collection was limited to Los Angeles. We used quantitative data that was derived from CPRS records only. So we could have gathered a lot more data in in-person assessments in a more detailed study. Our assessments were cross-sectional, so retrospective unmet needs certainly differ from needs that are identified in the midst of housing loss. We also lacked data about program fidelity to Housing First. So the Housing First model, where I presented in that early slide as we were defining the different types of homeless programs, has fidelity measures, and we don't know what those fidelity measures were within the VASH program in the year that we studied or within Los Angeles. Thinking about the problem-solving idea, each veteran's highest-order problem-solving approach was really limited by his or her most complex problem. So a totally different scenario would be to present veterans with a standardized set of problems and to ask them to solve the problems. We didn't do that here. So it's very possible that some people simply didn't have as complex problems as others. And I think all of us in our everyday lives solve some problems in a very rote way or rely on others or are able to use complex problem-solving depending on the level of complexity of the problem. Thinking about factors associated with VASH exits and thinking about problem solving is really highly relevant to this idea of improving care in the VASH program. In identifying high-risk veterans, when we're looking at veterans who are entering the VASH program, these data suggest the importance of factors across many of the different domains of our conceptual framework. In the predisposing domain, homelessness chronicity is certainly something that we should keep our eyes out for. This notion of intrinsic motivation or motivation to succeed at the veteran level may have some value. Unmet needs for mental health care and for independent living skills are certainly of interest to us and are unmet needs that we might be able to address through concrete interventions. Thinking about health service utilization behaviors, when we have someone in our clinical settings who's coming in asking to be admitted to the VASH program, a quick look at their healthcare utilization patterns in the year prior to VASH entrance might give us some clue about how high risk a person is. Looking at something like primary care engagement, emergency department utilization, and inpatient mental health admissions may present some sort of window into the level of intensity of services that a veteran in VASH will need. This idea of problem-solving approaches seemed highly relevant to everyday functioning and housing first, and we know that the processes used to solve key problems like how to get an apartment really vary dramatically between the three levels of problem solving and might be something that we want to think through a bit more and offer some interventions around. I wanted to spend a slide talking about this notion of program mandates. So it was really interesting to us, especially thinking about that Exeter group, that people were actually asking for more structured treatment. When VASH is rooted in this housing first paradigm where we link veterans to service regardless for adherence. So a few thoughts. If we're tailoring housing first for veterans who are very accustomed to the structure of military culture, or people with significant institutional history, which we really see a lot in this group, people who've been in boarding cares, people who've been in the criminal justice system, additional structure might be useful, and that might be a long-term structure or it might be a short-term structure to help ease that transition from an institutional setting into the housing first setting. We might want to also think about stratifying veterans by risk and thinking about our veterans, especially those with high mental health needs, high rates of emergency department and inpatient use for their mental health needs. A hybrid approach where we value choice but offer selected mandates might be useful. We also do want to think, though, that we are hearing veterans ask for mandates, and we're hearing them ask for that after the fact. Many of these individuals may not have enrolled in the program if we had required mandates when they actually signed on the dotted line to sign up for the VASH program. So it's something to think about. Additional implications. So within HUD-VASH, an average of 113 days passes between program enrollment and apartment movement. So the time between which you get an admission note in your chart saying that you are you qualify and you are enrolled in the VASH program and the time you move into the program, you've got between three and you've got like close to 4 months during that time. That might be an ideal time for some housing-related skills training, thinking about boosters that would continue after veterans achieve housing, thinking about skills training that could address a few different factors. And we'll go through that in the next bullet point. So future research could tailor and implement interventions from the mental health literature, thinking about things like provision of personalized budgets, social skills training, motivational interviewing, problem-solving interventions that could be applied across problems, or modules that are specific to discrete problems like financial management. The idea of assessments of acuity of needs at the beginning of VASH is something that's of great interest that's being rolled out nationally at the moment where there's a national mandate to identify people's levels of risk at the time of entrance into VASH. A detailed assessment that focuses on mental health needs may facilitate referrals to more intensive services. I think the question that lies in my mind is what do those intensive services look like and have those really been applied and tested and tailored for people in the homelessness world or are they really sort of currently in the mental health domain. That is an overview of the presentation. I'm happy to take any questions. You can either use your question pane and we can discuss them here. I'm also happy to take any emails later on today or later this week to answer questions about this project.
Thank you, Dr. Gabrielian. We do have one question queued up, and I saw another one just pop in. I had to change my headset, so if I sound terrible, please let me know and I'll make another change. But otherwise, you can launch right in.
I think you sound regarding, good.
Okay, thank you very much. Regarding veterans' perspectives on motivation over unmet needs, did you find this among both stayers and exiters?
Good question. We did find it amongst both stayers and exiters. I think some of our stayers had actually gone through the program several times, and they actually said, what was different for me this time is I really wanted it. Before, I just thought that I would enroll in this program, I'd get an apartment, and it would go easy. And what we heard is that this idea, veterans very much had this idea that if you want it, you are motivated to do what it takes to stay in that apartment. And that might include things like engaging in treatment. It might include things like sobriety. It might include working more closely with case management. So that was an interesting thing that we saw across both veteran groups.
Thank you. This question is really long, so it's going to take me a moment to get to the actual question. In the meantime, audience members, if you have a question, you can go ahead and use the GoToWebinar questions pane. It's one of the pop-outs in the GoToWebinar dashboard. You can use the little triangle to drop it down and go ahead and type a question in. But in the meantime, while I try to figure out the second question, third one came in, and it is, in the HUD-VASH exit study, there didn't seem to be a distinction between SC or SSDI income and earned income. Was employment considered?
You know, we did consider income. We did not consider employment status, as it was one of the variables we looked at. So we asked qualitatively about people's engagement in rehabilitative services, which includes vocational services, but we didn't look in the chart at vocational status. We didn't find income to be a significant variable that distinguished the exiters from the stayers looking at the pure monetary amount.
Thank you. I'll get a stab at it. Has primary care been called to attend this presentation or only social work and business office folk?
Good question. I think the HSR&D cyber seminars go out to the HSR&D listserv that encompasses both investigators in primary care and mental health. Whether there was a push specifically for primary care clinicians, I would guess not. I think that tends to happen in some of our homeless-focused presentations where our homeless PACT members might, for example, be made aware of a presentation like this. But I doubt within HSR&D that there's a specific focus. You might know more, Rob.
I do. It does go out to clinicians, lay people, and researchers. Next question. Other than mental health, what are the most prevalent health issues facing homeless vets?
Good question. I think, you know, certainly mental health and substance use disorders tend to come to the top of the list, but I think we don't want to underestimate the importance of chronic medical conditions. There are sort of unique things when we're thinking about chronic medical conditions in homeless patients. We often think of our geriatric population and homelessness as beginning at a much younger age than we would think of it in non-homeless populations, simply because of the lifestyle of living in substandard housing and how that can wear and tear on the body. We see high rates of chronic medical conditions really across the board, hypertension, diabetes, coronary artery disease. We certainly think about HIV/AIDS and hepatitis C as potentially having being of greater risk in the homeless population. I think what I would really just highlight is, you know, given the findings that we found, sort of bringing it back to the study, given the findings that we found about primary care engagement, that's really been demonstrated in many other studies as being critical for for homeless populations. I think we can think about primary care engagement as something that can help address chronic medical problems in a way that's sensitive to some of the unique needs of homeless patients, which may require different sort of goals of treatment. And we can think also of mental health and substance abuse problems, sometimes being better addressed in primary care settings for populations that don't care to engage in specialty mental health or addiction services. Hopefully that somewhat answers the question.
This person had a follow-up. Also, what number, what percent are male versus female?
In our sample, you know, I don't have that off the top of my head. I know we certainly did make an effort to purposefully select some women in our sample. I probably have that on one of the earlier slides. I can tell you that within the VASH program, I think 9 to 10% nationally are women. I bet that's probably more of the question they were asking.
I'm sorry, Sonia, I was muted. Were there any age-related issues that you found, either old age associated with more staying or the opposite?
You know, we didn't find that. So we didn't find on a sort of in our quantitative analysis, we didn't find this idea of older individuals being more likely to stay or younger people being more likely to exit. I do think that if you look in certain subpopulations, you might see very different results. So, for example, if you took a geriatric population, I would guess that there are very different predictors of exits. Similarly, if you took an OEF-OIF population, I would think there would be some distinct factors related to exits that you would get in some mixed methods work. I do think that when we've looked at this notion of cognition in other studies, you certainly would think of the idea of cognitive problems, dementia, earlier onset of dementia due to traumatic brain injury, and sort of the difficult lifestyle of living on the streets, you would think that those have implications in the long term. But we didn't find differences in this particular study.
Great, thank you. Has this study directly informed HUD-VASH case management in GLA?
I think that's an interesting question. I think the way that it has informed HUD-VASH case management is that it can play into this notion of an acuity assessment and who's best suited for HUD-VASH. So I think that nationally I mentioned there's a push to roll out an acuity assessment where we have a list of risk factors that are associated with premature exits or negative outcomes of any sort in supported housing. There's a plan to rank everyone on a standardized assessment and to influence acuity or sort of intensity of case management based on people's level of needs. So I think it plays a role in that. I think a lot of the factors that we highlight map on nicely to that instrument. I think there's a lot of larger scale changes happening in HUD-VASH that sort of reflect this sort of work with the idea of developing sort of embedded mental health services, developing increased collaborations with our homeless PAC teams that really reflect the sort of findings that we found in this study as well as other studies that have looked at VASH exits.
Thank you. Is there, whoopsie. Is there an assessment tool to identify the level of problem-solving sophistication?
So there is no formal assessment tool. What we have looked at and what we're looking at currently in another study is looking at formal cognitive assessments that have been validated in serious mental illness populations and trying to do those on homeless populations to see if there's correlations between people's cognition and their housing outcomes. I think that gets at something else, though, because cognition is something that would sort of predate your performance, which would be like the qualitative problem-solving skills, and those two things together would influence your outcome of housing. So we're hoping to look at that in this current HSN R&D project that we're looking at where we do some cognitive assessments. We are doing some problem solving. We're capturing some problem solving data from our qualitative data and seeing how those map on to longitudinal housing outcomes. So I think the answer that I can best give is that's sort of in the works.
Okay, great. Wherever the patient is, is their medical home, and we need to bring our services to them. This is so obvious with the homeless subset. How can we enlist primary care up front and better share a comprehensive care plan, change our follow-up processes for our homeless vets?
It's a good point. I think it sort of goes to the notion of, you know, we have the fantastic Homeless Pact program that is implemented in different ways across the country. I think in some of the homeless packs, there actually is a lot more of that ability to go on the streets and provide field-based services. I think if you think about our MCM program, that's another sort of similar argument that we could make, where how could we expand MCM to actually address homelessness and adapt MCM to address substance abuse and some of the other problems that we see in the homeless population. So this idea of bringing services to the field, this idea of doing an acuity assessment on folks as they enter BASH, identifying the high-risk people and having a field-based primary care or mental health team. Does it look like a mobile homeless pack? Does it look like a MCM enhanced team for homeless patients? I don't really know, but I would certainly agree this idea of bringing services to the veterans and making that service that we bring more than social services but encompassing medical and mental health care, that's really a key direction that BASH is moving towards.
Excellent. Thank you. We do have a number of questions queued up. So how are veterans who exit the BASH program in less than a year for positive reasons classified? Are they stayers?
They were not included in the study. So that's a separate group, and we did not include them in our total sample size. But they are listed in homes, and there is the ability to get that data and to look at predictors if someone was interested. But they are not included in our stayer group.
Okay. How were veterans' families and or social networks incorporated into the study?
So what we did do there, and that's something that's of great interest to me, we did probe a bit qualitatively about services that would help link veterans to friends, family, or other social network. We didn't do any formal social network analysis, any formal social support measures on this population. What we are doing in the study I mentioned that looked at cognition, that's looking at cognition and its correlations to problem solving and outcomes, we are getting some more detailed social support measures in that study. We didn't look at that in too much depth, and I would agree that it's something that's very relevant for your ability to retain housing.
Did you talk with veterans about the outcomes that they thought were important to consider? If yes, what did you learn from those conversations?
The outcomes that they thought were important. So I'm not sure I quite understand the question. I think the outcome that we were most interested in was housing retention. I think what the person asking the question might be getting to is that veterans' sort of individual recovery goals can certainly differ. Some people, their goal might be to go back to work. Some people, their goal might be to reconnect with family. So we asked about vocational services that they, in terms of asking about services, we asked about linkages to vocational services. We asked about linkages to social services, but we didn't look at other recovery-oriented outcomes or get a clear glimpse of what veterans prioritized. Is there other functional outcomes? Because we were really focused on this housing outcome in this particular study.
That person, if that wasn't addressed, that person can go ahead and follow up. Did you interview any female veterans? And if so, did you find any differences compared to males?
We did interview female veterans. You know, we had a question about this earlier, so I want to pull up that slide. I didn't want to. I believe it's going to be here. I didn't put up the age breakdown of our 20 and 20, but we certainly did interview female veterans. I would say that our sample size of female veterans in this study, I believe, I don't know off the top of my head, but I believe it was about 5 or 6 female veterans out of 40, because we really made an effort to oversample them in our qualitative data. I would say that we don't have the sample size to really look at that. I think that female veterans as a whole, when we look quantitatively nationally, are more likely to be stayers than men. I think there's something inherently different, and I think this idea of social networks and social support that was brought out certainly is different. I know I clinically work in one of our women's programs in the homeless program, and you certainly see something different about our women that are homeless. You certainly see that they often are sicker. You certainly could speculate that women have to go further in terms of breaking bridges in their social networks in order to become homeless. But we didn't look at that in this study, and I think it would be something interesting to look at in further research.
What about ethnicity? This person said they had to step away and they may have missed it, so could you review?
So I don't have our race and ethnicity figures up, but I happen to know approximately what they are, which is typical for our studies in the homeless program in Los Angeles, which really reflects our population in Los Angeles. It's predominantly a population that self-identifies as racial ethnic minorities. Usually we have around 70% being African American, about 15% identifying as Hispanic, and the others a smattering of white and other ethnicities. So it's a predominantly African-American sample in both the Stairs and Exeters. We did not find any racial ethnic differences between the two groups.
Are veterans being gathered together to create business development hubs so that vets can work with other vets in support of housing as a collaborative approach? In other words, are vets being supported in developing entrepreneurial skills to adjust better?
That's a fantastic idea. I can't say that it's definitely not being done. I can say that I'm not familiar with any efforts for that to be done. I think that's something that I would really advocate in sort of the mental health world as well. I think if we think about these settings in which, you know, we have this system where if you get a job and you make too much money to be in the VASH program, for example, then you end up being out of the program. You have to pay your own rent. And if you lose that job, it can be challenging to get back in the program because you're not chronically homeless. We've seen this argument many times in the mental health world where people are sort of incentivized to stay disabled for financial purposes. Thinking about that, if we can find some way for people to work together to increase their functioning, be it in volunteer work, be it in entrepreneurial efforts, something that gives them structured vocational aims to work on a daily basis, I think it would be a great idea. I just don't know of any efforts along those lines.
Okay, thank you. Do women vets tend to have children or no children if homeless?
Good question. You know, we've looked at that data in other settings briefly, but I can't say that I know it off the top of my head. There is a variable in the HOMES database that looks at whether or not veterans, male or female, have dependent children. I can tell you in our sample of 40, I believe we had two women who had dependent children. The other women, that's probably close to about half the women that we interviewed. I don't think that's necessarily reflective of the population as a whole. I know that when we've looked at homes, the rate of having a dependent child that you're living with is relatively low, but I just can't name that percentage off the top of my head with any accuracy.
Thank you. It's now 3:57. We have two more questions, so it looks like we're going to have just enough time. You have nicely explored reasons for exiting VASH. Did you find a lack of trust in the VA was a component of vets in their problem solving to decide to leave, or was it due to inadequately diagnosed and or treated mental health conditions?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think this population, when we've looked at VASH previously and we've looked at rates of VA engagement in services, for example, we know that veterans in VASH use a tremendous amount of services. And while there may be this underlying distrust in the VA, this is a group that when they get housed, they tend to use the VA a lot, regardless of their trust level. Certainly there are sort of diagnostic considerations, persecutory delusions and schizophrenia, avoidance behavior with PTSD, just sort of apathy and that you can see in depression that might sort of distance people from the VA. But I don't think that's what was at the core of our problem-solving skills, nor do I think that symptoms alone explain some of the problem-solving deficits that we saw. What I think we saw was really this sort of underlying inability to solve problems that might be reflective of some sort of neurocognitive construct or really simply lack of practice with a lot of these sort of independent living problem-solving skills that you may not need to use much when you're homeless, or maybe perhaps led to someone becoming homeless. So I wouldn't say it's a simple translation between symptoms and problem solving. I would say there's maybe something that sort of predates symptoms, something more more at the core of people's functional problems that really resulted in these problem-solving deficits, and something that we might want to accommodate for when we're developing an intervention. So if we're developing an intervention to teach problem-solving skills, we may need to break it down into very, very simple steps to accommodate people's sort of functional limitations that might be due to cognitive problems, symptoms, or other sort of factors.
Dr. Gabrielian, one of the questioners is asking if you would forward to the point of contact slide.
Oh, yes, I can definitely do that. Sorry.
Last slide.
That way we can I can take emails.
Right. And the that last question that you were just addressing, I feel as though I have to add that this doctor added after the question, i.e. paranoia with schizophrenia, which I feel is rare as opposed to mistrust after trying to access PTSD help and becoming frustrated. So it sounded like exactly what you were saying for my lay person perspective.
Mm-hmm. No, I would definitely agree that those can both lead to a lot of mistrust, as well as just poor experiences with the VA and navigating bureaucracy outside of mental health problems. That can lead to a lot of distrust of VA.
Okay, here's your final question. Was the study focused on only tenant-based vouchers, or was project-based included?
So project-based was included, but the number of people that we had in project-based in our qualitative sample, I would say, was very low, no more than two. So we looked at VASH as a whole, but I would certainly agree that there are differences between the project-based groups. For anyone still on the line who's not familiar, project-based VASH is sort of an apartment building, for example, that's delegated to VASH versus scattered site VASH, VASH apartments in the traditional community. So I think that would be an interesting study to do, to look at exits of project-based VASH specifically. This is mostly focused on our scattered site housing that's in the community.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, that's about all the time we have. If you have any closing comments, I think now would be the time.
No closing comments for me. I'm happy to take questions or to chat with people afterwards if they're interested to shoot me an email.
I think that you're going to get at least one.
Sounds good.
Okay. Well, thank you again for doing such important work and for preparing and presenting today. For the audience members, when I close the cyber seminar, you'll be presented with a short survey. Please do take a few moments and fill out those questions. We really do count on you, and we address those answers and concerns to continue to bring high-quality cyber seminars. Thanks again, everybody. Thank you, Dr. Gabrielian. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you.